Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Cathode Ray Mission. I'm your host, Adam Ferens, and tonight our topic of discussion is the director F.W. Murnau. Joining me tonight are Sammy Giuliano. Say hello.
Hello. Hello.
And Aaron White. Say hello.
Hello.
So, you know, Murnau is an interesting guy. He was German. He died young in a car accident. He was in his early 40s. He just started to work in the United States after establishing himself in silent cinema over in Europe. And then in the United States, he was beginning to make talking movies. He had made classic films or now classic films like Nosferatu and Sunrise, Faust, The Last Laugh. He established or altered several different genres of film, but then he died. Apparently he had a 10-year contract with Fox or a 10-picture deal, something like that. And he just signed it. He was taking a break between projects and died in a car accident. There are, of course, some nasty rumors about what happened, but all of it's untrue. Thank you, Ken Anger and Hollywood Babylon. Without further ado, I want to get into the meat of the topic, and that is, how did we first come to Murnau's work? Sammy.
How did I first come to Murnau's work? Well, I guess I can say that, like many my age and that can look back on why they sought out a specific director or why they came upon a director, it was college related. I had a class the second part of my getting my bachelor's degree was at Jersey City State College in New Jersey, and I enrolled in a course which was movie classics, and in the class you would watch a full length film on a projector every week, and I remember the professor was Herbert J. Leder, who was a pipe smoking guy with long stringy hair, who was a director of a couple of films. One of them was called The Frozen Dead with Dana Andrews, sort of a cheesy sci-fi movies from the early 60s, and he actually directed it. Like so many others that direct, and there are others that I know that did the same, they wind up in colleges teaching film when their career either fizzles out or it completes. And he was teaching this course showing films, and that's where I saw Nosferatu. That was the first Murnau film that I saw. I was in my early 20s. I'm sure like Aaron and many others, I was watching films from a very early age. But I didn't start to take cinema seriously until my late teens, early 20s. So the very first film I saw by Murnau was Nosferatu. And after you see a film that you're so impressed with, try and seek out other films by the director. And in the ensuing years, I was able to see Sunrise. And then when I met Alan Fish, he gave me another pep talk on Murnau. And I informed him I had already seen Nosferatu and Sunrise by that point. But needless to say, I was hooked on him then. And, well, I won't say much more because I'll answer another question. I'll just turn it over to Aaron.
Well, you know, before we go to Aaron, I'm going to say that I had, when I was young, and I mean when I was like 7, 8, 9, 10, I used to get books from the library that were on old movies. And there were some great books at the time, William K. Everson. There was another gentleman whose name escapes me now. But they did these wonderful books with lots and lots of pictures of old horror films. And I came upon photographs of many movies, you know, Vampire, and, you know, you found out there's more movies in the Frankenstein and Dracula series than just, like, you know, Dracula's Daughter or Bride of Frankenstein, that there were, like, five or six sequels. But there was this movie that the images just stayed with me. And they announced in the book that the film was extremely hard to find, had at one point been considered lost, and I made it a mission as a little kid to find this film. And that film, of course, was Nosferatu. So just like you, Sammy, I came to Murno through Nosferatu. And while it took me several years as a kid to hunt it down I did. I pestered several video stores. I don't know if it was actually me or if it just happened. But one time in the fall, I remember it being in the fall. I don't know if it was because Halloween was coming up or what, but I happened by the video store. And what the hell did I see? I saw a VHS of Nosferatu sitting there. You bet your ass I bought it. Or I had my parents buy it for me. So that's my story. And the rest is history. So what about you, Aaron? How did you come to Murno?
Well, like Sammy, I actually got to I was at the end of high school, beginning of college. This story will amuse you, so because I go to the same source so often, so we might as well tell the story here. I was on a mission of mercy one time to bring a car to someone in Washington, D.C. And once we got on the Beltway to D.C., they said, oh, we had to go back to our hotel. And we were on a day trip to D.C. We said, where are you now? And they said, we're in Newark. And so we're on the Beltway to D.C., and we have to turn around, and now we have to drive through Maryland and Delaware and all of New Jersey to get to Newark and find this guy's hotel room to drop off a car. The other driver ended up getting a migraine, so I kicked around in a bookstore in a mall somewhere in Newark and found on the shelf the first two volumes, because that's all there were at the time, of Roger Ebert's great movie essays. I bought them both, and life has never been the same. But the Nosferatu essay starts with my perhaps all-time favorite turn of phrase from Mr. Ebert. He says, to watch F.W. Murnau's Nosferatu is to see the vampire movie before it sees itself. And how can you not just die to see that movie once you've read that line? Nosferatu, I just like the two of you, it was the first one I found on some public domain website somewhere in the dredges of the internet. I probably watched it the same night as I watched The Passion of Joan of Arc. So good night for me.
yeah, man, hell of a night.
There you have it.
Well, damn. So now I'm going to ask this question, and I'll put it back to you, Sammy. It's the big one. What major theme or themes, you know, what special interests or motifs or, and such, what recurring themes occurs in, seem to follow in Murnau's work?
Well, I mean, you're saying overall themes or just themes in specific works? This is an overall question, or is it a scene-specific
question? What does he seem to be most interested in exploring via his work?
Well, I mean, obviously, he was heavily influenced by the German Expressionists, and his, you know, he's as visual a director as you'll ever find. I mean, he defines the very, you know, notion of cinema as an art form from using all the visual motifs. I mean, and certainly his, you know, I mean, he's literary in the sense Nosferatu is loosely based on Stoker's novel, but he refines for a theater person who, you know, was heavily influenced by, I think it was Max Reinhardt, and, you know, different philosophers, including Shakespeare, Nietzsche, and Schopenhauer. And so you would think that this would be somebody who would be very theatrical in ways, but he's the exact opposite. So, you know, in his, you know, themes, he examines light, you know, versus darkness, or light versus shadow, and, you know, cities versus countries, you know, the pastoral versus urban areas, and he examines, you know, the biggest universal themes, you know, of jealousy and greed and lust and infidelity, and he brings these to roost with some of the most stunning canvases that the cinema has ever seen to this very day. But again, I'm jumping on to other questions because I see that several of your questions are being very specific in that regard. But he examines big themes, and he, you know, he gives them, you know, intoxicating showmanship in presenting them. I don't know if I said that right, but I think you know where I'm coming from.
Oh, we do. Yeah, so, yeah. Aaron, what about you?
Yeah.
This may just be, you know, the literary critic in me, but I watch his films and I just cannot help but put it through a queer lens. And everything he does, I think, comes back to his homosexuality, his themes of lust, of alienation, of society versus the individual, things that I think see again in German cinema with Fassbinder, but less melodrama and more visual flair. I see him as really the first truly queer auteur. I think everything gets filtered through that lens in his work.
And yet it was Dreyer who did Michael. Dreyer.
So now, Sammy, here's a question. You know, we've discussed this just a little bit. You know, you touched on it just a little bit. But what do we think, you know, and you can expound on this because you held yourself back there. But specifically, what do you see as his influences and where? Like, you know, if you're going to name an influence, then name something, then cite an example in his work if you can.
Well, I mean, all right, I'll have to repeat it, maybe just expound a little on it. But he worked with Max Reinhardt, and I believe he worked, with theatrical Midsummer Night Dreams, and then Reinhardt did that on film, but that was years after Murnau died. But there were, you know, he was heavily influenced by a cadre of great philosophers, and he incorporated a lot of that into his films. I mean, the German Expressionism was one part of how he was influenced cinematically. I also believe he was influenced by Swedish cinema, the early Swedes. Now, there's been studies done on that, but, some of the earliest Swedish masterworks that influenced him, I'm trying to think if I see the time frame of Skoberg, whether or not it was Skoberg's early films that influenced him. I'm not sure how the time is falling down in this. Maybe Aaron knows that because he's such a big Bergman fan. He's probably familiar with Skoberg because he was the star of Wild Strawberries. He was known as Victor Seastrom back in those days. So, he was influenced by European cinema, especially the German Expressionism, because that comes out in his work most persuasively. But you asked me then, who did he influence? Is that right?
Well,
who influenced
the first question
him?
Was who had influenced yeah. him. So,
oh,
so
okay.
now we're going to give. So now we're going to give Aaron
okay.
a chance. So,
yes,
what
yes.
do you see as
influences? Yeah. Oh, I can't really argue with the Expressionists. I think that especially his German work is just probably. Let me figure out how to phrase this. I prefer the films of Fritz Lang, but I think that Murnau was the most perfect expressionist in cinema. I think that if you want to study German expressionism in any of its forms, that you don't really need to look further than the three German masterpieces that he made there right at the end of his German career before coming to America. Sunrise has a little bit of it, but not nearly the same way. And then the other two American films are definitely American films. But just look, Nosferatu may be the most perfect piece of German expressionism there is. If the art form is an external representation of the internal emotion, what is Nosferatu, Count Olaf, but that? Like, all of his inner evil, all of his inner hatred for society that has turned its back on him is expressed in how he looks, how he walks, how he talks. Well, we assume how he talks because it's a silent picture. I don't get access to him.
No, I think it's interesting you bring that up because the film Shadow of the Vampire, which had Willem Dafoe and John Malkovich in it as Shrek and Murnau during the making of the film, and for those who aren't familiar, that movie purports that Shrek actually was a vampire, but they definitely explore the way that Murnau's sexuality influenced his filmmaking, and specifically the way that he viewed Orlok and how he was going to be portrayed. So that's interesting. That is interesting. So now, Sammy, the next question. Who did Murnau influence?
Well, I'll give you one. One of your favorites. And Mr. Malick, and specifically Days of Heaven, which was
well known.
City Girl connects heavily with Days of Heaven. The whole pastoral style of that film can be seen directly in Days of Heaven. I believe Malick, in interviews, acknowledged the influence that Murnau's cinema had on him. But I would venture to, add that his style his montage style was also adopted as the years went by in the early Hollywood. And I Aaron mentioned Lang. I believe that, Lang had a longer career, and I'd be hard pressed to argue that anybody who prefers Lang is wrong, because there was so much more. Murnau unfortunately died young, and having all these masterpieces, but they certainly didn't match up to Lang's filmography. In the early Lang films, you could see the crisscross of the Murnau and Lang and their style in the M, some of the earlier ones. Could even be argued that, I guess, Murnau was influenced by some of Lang's early films, the 20s, the silent films. I don't know. I don't know that to be sure, but I'll stick with Malick as the main one that I said at the outset.
So what about you, Aaron? Who do you see him as having influenced? Aaron, are you there?
Thing out.
Oh, okay.
Am I there?
Yeah, you're there now.
Yes, I hear you. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm going to start with, I think, the big one, Alfred Hitchcock. I think Lang's influence is, I think, more prominent because of their themes, but Hitchcock had such a flair for the visuals. I think that Murnau was definitely influential on his work, especially the early British work. Looking specifically at the masterpieces like The Man Who Wasn't There, The 39 Steps, even in some of his early American work like Rebecca and Notorious, a lot of expressionism in those films. And another one who is going to seem less obvious is John Ford. But his silent work very much is a piece with Murnau's work.
Especially in some of his early talking work. There's a movie he did where Henry Fonda plays a priest, and that's got Dutch angles, and definitely feels very much like Murnau directed it. But no, you're not wrong. Some of Ford's early work definitely has a Murnau influence on it. Ooh. So now, Sammy, we will go back to you. And I'm going to ask this question. Had he lived, do we think Murnau could have become successful with talking pictures as he was with silent cinema? And I know that's one of those questions that people say good historians shouldn't ask these speculative questions, but, you know, this show isn't exclusively history, so I'm going to ask it. So what do you think, Sammy?
That's a difficult question to really, you know, put your hands around. You know, there's part of me that thinks that, you know, that he was an established director of incomparable greatness, and that had he lived during the sound era, he would have been able to cross over the same way that the aforementioned Hitchcock did, and John Ford and others, that Lang, since they all successfully crossed over, it's a no-brainer to conclude that that Murnau would. However, there's a little asterisk next to such an opinion, because he was so visual, and that, you know, that's where his talent lied, and because in silent cinema brought that out, you know, the same way that you know, Gantz mastered that, and then his talkies were less effective. To give an example, the French director Abel Gantz. I'm really torn to give you a conclusive answer. I don't know. I would have to say that he would have made some other very outstanding pictures, but I wonder if anything that he made after that point would have matched his very best films during the silent era, which are among the greatest films ever made. So that's my position. It's a inconclusive position. Maybe Aaron will break the tie and weigh heavy one way or the other. I'm going to just pass that. Yeah.
So what do you think, Aaron?
I'm actually going to give it a firm no. And for the reasons that Sammy mentioned, his films are almost like actual pieces of visual art. They are visual spectacles. I think at times they're very light on story because he just wants you to experience the feelings of the pictures. And so I don't know, especially in those early days of the talkies where they are so talky and the camera doesn't move, and like he would have lost all of the technical advantages he had that made him so great. His pictures would have been overlit. His pictures would have been undershadowed. He got it down with Sunrise and City Girl, to where he had title cards like once every 5 minutes. There was just no dialogue in his film. And I just, especially again in those early days, like think about someone like Ernst Lubitsch, who just took off when the talkies came because his pictures were talking before talking. I see it having an opposite effect on him. Lang and Hitchcock, who arguably are the filmmakers who made the most towering masterpieces on both sides of the split, especially Lang. Hitchcock
yeah.
really only had a couple of good silent films. But Lang was always story heavy. His visuals, while outstanding, often took a back seat to the plot. And he would always find a way to fit the plot or the visuals around the plot. Whereas Murnau was a visual artist. And
the big exception with Lang being Destiny, I would say.
Yes. That's his true, like, expressionist film. So I'm coming in with a hard no. I would love to see the universe in which he lived, and I would love to see his pictures and see if I was right or wrong. But that's where my speculative answer is going to lie for now. Shoot, Charlie Chaplin couldn't make a talkie. I mean, he could, but not the same way. Let's see here. Yeah. So Charlie Chaplin, who was doing pictures in America right at the seam also, kept making silent films well past the point that anyone else was making them. And I think that he had some of the same fears that Monroe would have had, which is that...
Okay, guys, I'm back. Sorry about that.
Well, he did do Monsieur Bordeaux and Limelight, which were arguably very, very good films. I mean, and they were talkies.
That's
but,
true.
I mean,
and The Great Dictator had some, but not, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't dialogue driven.
No.
Right, right.
So, so now I'm going to ask some more specific questions. And, well, we're going to ask actually this one first, and it's going to go to Sammy again. And that is, what do we think Murnau's greatest strength was as a director?
Yeah, well, I mean, we did broach that earlier. His strength was again, you know, was lyricism and you know, the visual style you know, juxtaposition of images and light versus dark and city versus country. He was very, very effective in drawing contrasts, stark contrasts, and. You know, these were visual poems, you know, he made, and, you know, he had the background to do, literary films, but he was able to see the cinema as a separate art form. And that's how, you know, he presented his film as cinema, one of the most cinematic directors we've ever had. So, you know, his strength was with the camera. And, you know, that goes back to the other question, what would have happened afterwards? Well, I mean, Aaron made a very good point. It was speculative, yes, but it was a good point that once bereft of that strength, that visual strength, and then having to, you know, go towards Lubitsch, you know, maybe it would have fizzled out. I don't know. Even with his, he was an incredible intellectual with so much incredible background in every field. So you would have to think that wouldn't come to that because he was one of the most brilliant people that's ever directed films. Overall, one of the most consummate, diverse geniuses in cinema history. So you would say maybe that would not be the case. But be that as it may, I'm expecting Aaron to back me up on the interview.
And yes, I would have to agree with you. You know, when I think of Murnau, I think of the visuals. I mean, I think of that a little bit with Long, but you also think about the way the stories unfold and how everything's like a well-oiled machine. You know, his films are tight like a Swiss watch, and they spring into action. But not a Murnau film. Murnau's movies are a little more leisurely and much more lyrical and visual. So what about? And I would say that his visual storytelling is almost second to none in his era. But like I said, almost. I'm not sure anybody was better, but there's a few that I would put on a level with him. So what about you, Aaron?
Shadows. All right, I mean, you guys took everything I wanted to say, so I'm just going to say Shadows. He's a visual artist. He's an expressionist, and the way he paints with light, and he does it in black and white. He doesn't screw around with monochrome like Lang did. He just puts it all there. And the other thing is, I think Sammy was getting at it when he was talking about the visual poetry. He has a way of invoking emotion just through his images. Like Emil Jannings was a larger than life personality. But like his films would have done fine without him, as blasphemous as that probably is to say, because he really doesn't ask for that much from his actors because he's doing all the work. And he's invoking the feelings through the imagery itself more than the story and more than the performance.
So now the flip side of this, and that is, what is his greatest weakness, his biggest flaw as a director? Sammy?
I saw that question there, and I'm still trying to come up with an answer for it. His flaw, when we get to the point of what's my least favorite Murnau film of the ones I've seen, I could give a better answer. His flaw may have been that he, may have been his strength, that it was such an overwhelming, I mean, as opposed to somebody like Dreyer, when he made Joan of Arc, nobody can say that his expressionistic style dwarfed the performance of Falconetti, which, of course, he nurtured out
Correct.
Of a, with painstaking, torture, sadism, torture that he brought out of Falconetti. But so, he was involved in that too. But I mean, Dreyer was different. Dreyer did rely on his performances. That was also true in Day of Wrath and other films. Whereas I agree with Aaron, the actors in Murnau's films were like pawns for the director's vision. So whether or not one could dig deeper and find an actual flaw in that manner of presentation, I don't know. I the flaw is the strength and vice versa. I can't say that I had any flaw that I noticed myself that I'm willing to talk about. I thought and thought and thought about it in the afternoon, and I'm not able to. The flaw would be maybe, the lesser films, like, a film that I admired that I thought was a failed effort was called Phantom, one of his earliest films. I do have that on DVD. Remember, Alan was promoting it with reservations. But, the flaw was that he didn't perfect his form at that point. It was early on. Now you have a hint as to the film I'm going to say is the weakest, that one.
So, Aaron, what about you? What do you think his greatest flaw is?
I'm going to agree with Sammy with a caveat and say that his flaw is that he knew his strength so well that when, on the rare occasion when he didn't have it, that the film fell completely flat. If a film of his does not have just stunning visuals, there's nothing there. And again, we'll talk about this more I'll mention two other films. The Finances of the Archduke, I think, Grand Duke.
Yeah.
The Finances of the Grand Duke and The Haunted Castle are two films that the visuals are not there in the same way they are in the others. And the story, as I've mentioned, is just, it's not there. He's not a storyteller, and that's okay. It's a visual film. He doesn't have to be a storyteller. But if he's making a narrative film and his ace in the hole is missing, he doesn't have a hand to play with, is all I'll leave it there.
right. So
I didn't see the former film that Aaron mentioned, the first. I didn't see that film. I only saw The Haunted Castle. I didn't see that other film you mentioned there. All right, well.
So now, and this is separate from Murnau's, from our favorite film, or at least it could be. I guess we could have a favorite that we consider this. But Sammy, which Murnau movie do you think is actually his most underrated? Is the one that people don't give enough love to, but that you think they should?
Well, I was tempted initially to say either Faust or Taboo. I was tempted. I don't think Faust is underrated. It's rated quite highly. In fact, there are some devout Murnau fans who hold that near the very top. Barry Jumanski thinks it's his greatest film. I don't think it's his greatest film, but it certainly is not any longer underrated. What he did there with that, the Faustian legend, was incredible. I mean, and it is widely acknowledged as in the upper tier, not quite in the top three, but in the upper tier of his work. Therefore, I'm going to go with the film that I think time will rescue if it hasn't already rescued it, and that's the third film he made with Fox, the very last film that he made, City Girl, which I talked about early in this conversation. I think that is his most underrated film. In many ways, it's a pastoral work of great beauty that kind of mirrored some of the plot points of Sunrise, which, of course, it followed. And it's certainly not as great a film as Sunrise, but it's actually an extremely beautiful, moving film, especially the first half. That brings out a lot of what we loved about Murnau in the earlier films. I know there's some criticism about how it all wound up in the second half plot itself, but the visual style. The point of view of the visual style actually were different in a sense, because Sunrise had more of a that haunting, dreamlike poetry, whereas City Girl, is more of a austere naturalism, almost documentary style in a sense. So, here I'm kind of like going back and backtracking. I'm saying they're similar, and they are similar in ways, but then, of course, they're different. They're markedly different, but I do know the reason why I chose that one, because I do know there are some critics and film fans that didn't like City Girl, and I was grateful that Masters of Cinema Eureka thought enough of that film to bring it out on Blu-ray, and they couldn't.
Yeah, I have their copy.
I have. You have it?
Yep.
You said you have it. Yeah. Okay, so you know what I'm talking about. They brought it out. I know Alan Fish is a big fan of City Girl. I mean, not as much as Sunrise, which he has said on numerous occasions is the greatest film ever made, number one. But
He did love City Girl, and he was promoting.
Yeah, that's actually one of the things that he and I bonded over was our mutual love for Sunrise.
Right.
He was like, well, where do you have it? And I was yank, and I said number four. He said, fair enough.
Yes. Yeah, somebody today said to me, no, they wrote on Facebook, he thought Heroes Plus Massacre by Yoshida was the greatest film ever made. I said, no, he didn't. He thought that film was the number one movie of the 1960s, not the number one movie of all time. I have his lists. I know what he said.
Yeah, and he thought it could be the most underrated Japanese film ever.
Right. Japanese. Well, no, he didn't have it. He had it as the number one movie of the 60s. His number one Japanese movie ever was Tokyo Story. That was his
top. Well, no. I said most underrated. He actually said that. He said, you know, it's unfortunate
to have a proper
release and not enough people have heard of it. It's probably the most underrated great Japanese film ever.
Right. But anyway, going back to what I was saying, I could understand Murnau people saying that Faust is the most underrated film. I could buy that. It's just that I think time has, in the last couple of decades, you know, Faust has been elevated, you know, over and over, you know, to whereas it's in the upper tier. I just don't feel it's underrated anymore. I think it's quite rated highly. So that's why I didn't pick that one. But Aaron may disagree, so let him take over.
So, yeah, Aaron, what do you think that his most underrated film is?
I think that he has an American film that has never gotten a proper American release, and that is City Girl. I agree with everything Sammy said. I think City Girl is easily his most underrated film. And I think it comes back to what I was saying was his biggest flaw. It's, other than Nosferatu, his film with the strongest story. He's not falling back and just mailing it in with the visuals. He never mails it in with the visuals. He's not leaning back on the visuals and letting the story take care of itself. He's actively pursuing the story. And that was huge, huge to see. And I agree with everything you said about Faust. I do think that it finally, if we had done this show even a couple of years ago, I think that it would have been my pick. But I do think that it's finally where it belongs as far as his films and its reputation.
Well, you know, let's put it this way. This is scary because we three are in lockstep on this topic. Absolute lockstep.
that's a great thing.
So now we come to the fun question. What's his weakest movie, Sammy?
Well, I spilled the beans earlier. Of the ones that I saw, I didn't see the first film that Aaron mentioned. I don't even remember the name now. Can you refresh my memory?
Grand Duke.
So I haven't seen that. But anyways, I've seen just about all of his films. And, Phantom was the one that I was just unsatisfying to me. It was a difficult film. I mean, I know where he was coming from. There was a lot of brilliant sequences and so on, but it just didn't come together. It was just an experimental film from, you know, very early on. And what year was that? Was it 20?
20, I think.
20, yeah, okay. So I like a lot of it. No Murnau movie is without merit, but I just felt that...
1922
you know,
for
more,
Phantom.
What's that?
22.
Okay, 22. All right. So that's the one that I thought was the, you know, you used the word weakest. Okay, so I'll say it was the weakest. I have it on DVD anyways if I ever want to rewatch it. But yeah.
Yeah, I have that early Murnau set that Masters of Cinema did, which is amazing. So what about you, Aaron? What's your choice for his worst?
Well, full disclosure, I did not get a chance to see Phantom or Burning Soil. So
oh, God,
I'm
don't.
With, with nine of his films. And The Haunted Castle.
And he only
Castle
has 12 films left that exist.
I have 11. What? Anyway, I must be missing one at some point. Anyway, The Haunted Castle to me. He teases this ghost story, and he sets up what should be just incredible haunting images, and they never pay off. Like their point, like the images aren't evocative. They're not frightening. They're not moving. They're just there, completely devoid of the story that he's telling about this castle. And the title's misleading. There's no actual haunting. It's very much like the people are haunted by their inner turmoil, not by any supernatural forces. And it's just so boring. It's like watching paint dry. It's like an 80-minute movie, and I don't think I watched all of it. I just couldn't sit through it. So, yeah, he let that one for me just did not work at all.
Well, for me, it is going to be Burning Soil, which you'd think, you know, with some horror elements, it might actually be good, but it isn't. It just is not any good. But to settle the question, and this is something that the audience may be interested. He started directing movies in 1919, and he has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 straight lost movies. His first film that still exists is Der Gang in der Nacht, or Journey into the Night, followed by Schlossverwald, or The Haunted Castle. Now, he has a film called Maritza, which is considered lost. Only one reel exists. Then we have The Brande Acher, or The Burning Soil, Nosferatu, Phantom. Then there's another lost one, The Explosion. Then there's The Finances of the Grand Duke, The Last Laugh, Tartuffe, Faust, Sunrise, Four Devils is, of course, legendarily lost, City Girl, and Taboo. And then Comedy of the Heart is one that he did back in 1924, and that one he was only the writer, not the director. So, you know, that's how that goes. But we'll get back to this question and or this set of questions, and that is so. What are our top three Murnau films, Sammy?
Well, this is probably going to be, I don't know if it will be uniform here. He made three, although Faust is knocking hard on the door, knocking hard, and maybe that's going to be changed as we move forward, maybe a few more decades. Faust is trying to get into that top three very hard, but right now it's barely outside the door. And the three masterpieces, Sunrise, which is one of the greatest films of all time. Some people have it in the number one spot. It would be in my top five. There are a few days of the week where if you ask me what the greatest film ever made is, in my opinion, and I'll answer with that. You know, some days I'll think City Lights and Tokyo Story or Hazard Balthazar, Sancho the Bailiff, 2001, blah, blah, blah. But that would get some time in the number one position. So what else would come? I think Sunrise is his absolute masterpiece. I'm not buying any Nosferatu talk. I'm just not. It's a great film. It's number two, but it does not match Sunrise. Not in universal theme and beauty and overflowing emotion and in the art form brilliance of it. Nosferatu is a great horror film, early horror film, the best Dracula film ever made. Shrek is electrifying and so on. It was the introduction of Murnau to all of us, and it is a rightful masterpiece that is solidly in the number two position. That third film is The Last Laugh, which is just another brilliant work. And, it reminds you in a lot of ways, of course, von Sternberg's The Blue Angel, the defacement of the main character. But it's one of his great films in that the story works hand in hand with his visuals. It's not as visual as the first two films, but of course it's still a Murnau film and it is visual. The story is captivating, and I think it's earned its place in that top three. So again, it's Sunrise one, Nosferatu two, The Last Laugh three. Those are my
three. We're close, Sammy. We're close. So what about you, Aaron?
I'm going countdown style because I want to get this out of the way. Number three, I have Sunrise. Yeah, I'll take your tomatoes now. It's a beautiful film. It has never touched me in the emotional way that it has some other people. I can't tell you why. Actually, I can.
I think that just proves that it's art.
I feel like it just resolves itself so early in the picture. And then, like, what is it, like 81 minutes? And I feel like all of the conflict is resolved after the first 20. And then there's an entire hour where it's just, and then something else happened. And that's just how it's always struck me. You'll forgive me. I've seen it three times. I think it's beautiful. I think it's great. I think it's, yeah. Anyway, it's number three picture for me. Number two is The Last Laugh, which kind of backtracking here on a previous statement about Emil Jennings, because he is fantastic here. I think it's the one real performance in a Murnau picture other than Max Schreck that really matters to the film itself. Just great film, really moving. And then number one, Sammy, I'm a Faust guy. It's a visual feast, and it does everything for me that a silent film should do, which is keep me entertained, keep me awake, and fill my eyes with candy. not surprisingly, most of my favorite silent films come from the fantasy and horror genres, and Faust is one of the very best. So that's my top three.
Well, you know, here's the thing. Flip a coin, and my three and four could be one thing or the other. But tonight, for the purpose of this show, number three, Faust. Number two, The Last Laugh. Number one, Sunrise. Number four would have been Nosferatu, but as beautiful as Nosferatu is, as well made as it is, I do feel that Faust has some artistry to it that Nosferatu just lacks a little. But it's an epic film. The fact that you could have those four films and any one of them could rightfully be your top film, you did something right as a director. you really did.
Can I just ask you one question? I don't want to interrupt, but if this show had been on Dreier and we had talked about Vampyr, I dare say that probably everyone would be thinking in the same term, that Vampyr is a great, great film, but it's not quite in the, you know, at the top spot, maybe not at the second top spot of Dreier's films, right? Is that true? And that's a horror film, too.
Absolutely.
Yeah, if we were to go three Dreier movies, Vampyr would probably end up, I'm sure, like, if, you know, one person would have it at three, but the rest of us would probably have it at four and wish we'd put it at three, because I absolutely think that you have to have Passion and or Dead at one and two. So now I'm going to ask our last question before we get into some more specific discussion, because I think we have time for that tonight, and that is... what is Murnau's legacy, and where does he rank amongst directors? So, Sammy?
All right, well, we've been answering these questions in roundabout ways in the previous questions, but where does he rank? Well, for me, he would rank, in the top 10 film directors of all time, you know, in the same company as Bergman, Bresson, Ozu, Kubrick, Mizoguchi, Powell and Pressburger, perhaps Lang, Hitchcock. He would be, you know, with the ones I just mentioned and a couple of others that I didn't mention. But certainly he's, you know, a unique director who, you know, made his films at an era where he was, you know, where his style was able to be emulated by others. And, when you talk about cinema as an art form, you know, you have to mention his name when you use that term, art form, because that's how he directed his films. His legacy is he brought full forth cinema as an art form in the early days of cinema. That hasn't been replicated by most people afterwards. I mean, it's just that those films, some of his films that we mentioned are just, they're like great paintings would be in art. I mean, it's, his legacy is that he was able to shape and form the early art form into a genuine, you know, art house showcase. I mean, he's his legacy is going to be, you know, that he really did what the cinema strove to do in the early days, and which has been, of course, violated as we've gone through the decades for, you know, commercial concerns and all. But he treated it, not that he didn't want to make money, he didn't want his films to make money, but you know, he was the other director that I'd say that was like him in that the studio treated him badly and he wanted to make art was von Stroheim, especially with Greed, which was mutilated, beyond recognition. And even in its truncated form of 2 hours and 10 minutes, that film is going to rank as one of my greatest films of all time, even with everything that was cut out of it. Von Stroheim was a contemporary of Murnau, and he too strove to bring out the best in art house cinema. But his legacy is assured, and although Aaron is not, you know, where we are on Sunrise, even though he praised it, said a lot of great things about it, his legacy for me is that he made one of the greatest films of all time, one of the two or three greatest masterpieces of all time. That's my That's my persistent position on his legacy. That just the fact that he made one of the greatest films ever, that's ever been put before cameras, that to me assures his legacy, just as Dreyer's is assured by The Passion of Joan of Arc, in the same vein. So that's it. I'll move on to what what Aaron says now.
So, Aaron, your thoughts on this?
Once again, I'm gonna be the odd man out here. I have him. Okay, I guess it's been a while since we've talked about my tiered ranking system. So, I decided that I couldn't fairly judge one-to-one filmmakers anymore. So I've got the tiered system that's based on Greek mythology.
With the Bergman level, he's all by himself. And then I have 12 Titans, just like there's 12 Titans in Greek mythology. And I have the Mount Olympus tier, and there's 12 of those too, because there's 12 Greek gods. Then I have the 25 demigods, and then I have the heroes that round out the top 100. Guys, Murnau is firmly in the demigod section, probably towards the top, which puts him around like 26 or 7-ish. There's just not enough for me there yet. Like, maybe if we get some of those lost films back. His death at 42 was just so tragic.
And the fact that we don't have four devils, which some people say that they might have been the best.
Right. Well, I mean, the lost films in and of themselves, what were there, 12 more lost films on top of the 12 we have?
Well, quite a few.
Some 11 or 12, somewhere in there. It basically doubled his output. And then the fact that he died at 42, like, I wish we had more. I would be willing to have that conversation if we have more. But with what we have, the four masterpieces alone, and I consider him to have made four masterpieces that we have been able to see. Those four works put him solidly in like the 26, 27, because I am not that about the other films that we have. City Girl aside, I do like City Girl. I don't think it's a masterpiece, but I do think it's a wonderful film. But after City Girl, I think there's a really steep drop off. And so that kind of dampens my reaction to his filmography as a whole. And his legacy for me is always going to be Nosferatu. We all agree that it's not his best film. But I think it's become iconic in a way that none of his other films have.
Just feels like I think, you know, E.T. is probably going to be Spielberg's legacy, even though it's nowhere near being his best work.
Right, yeah, exactly. It's instantly recognizable, even to people who are not people who watch silent films. They know that's Nosferatu, even if they haven't seen the film. And so, yes, Sunrise is a better film. The Last Laugh, Faust, for me personally, are all stronger films. But for me also, Nosferatu is his legacy. And it's the one that we're 100 years after he was making films at this point. Nosferatu turned 100 this year.
Can you believe?
There aren't many films that last 100 years, guys. But Nosferatu is one of them. So.
Yeah, So now we come to the point, part of the show that I call housekeeping. And that's where I announce what's coming up on Deviant Legion. And what's coming up on Deviant Legion is this. On the 7th of this month, which is going to be Sunday, Rock This Town Radio with TC, Noah's Rock Boat, will be happening. So please be there. On the 9th, which will be Tuesday, we have the 9th on the 9th, a commentary watch of the 9th configuration. So please join Carl and crew for that as well. How, now for our show, for Cathode Ray Mission, we are going to be back next week on the 12th for a look at what I am calling the rise and fall of daytime drama. That's a look at, in brief, at the history of soap operas. I'll be joined by two super fans who have also done some writing, including one gentleman who has actually written a series of trivia and history books on the topic, Jerry Weggett. He'll be one of my guests next week, and I'm looking forward to this. This is a show that's been 3 years in the making, guys. 3 years to get the guests to line up. So I'm quite excited for this one. And I'm equally excited, maybe even more so in some ways, because I'm so caught up in these final episodes that are airing right now, and that is on the 19th, in 2 weeks from tonight, Cathode Ray Mission will be back with a look at Better Call Saul, which will be wrapping up the previous Monday. This will be the first time we've ever done an episode on a show that was essentially current, and it is just a phenomenal show. If you haven't been watching it, please do. Go binge watch it. There's 6 seasons now. Do yourself a favor. Get it. If you were holding off saying, how can it be any good? It's based on that lawyer from Breaking Bad. It's simply one of the greatest shows of all time. So now, turning back to Murnau, I'm going to ask you guys, would you guys both like to dig into some of these movies a little more? Are you feeling up for it, or would you kind of like to get going? Because I know it's a little late for you guys.
I'm good
well,
either way.
We've said what we had to say. It's funny that, you know, different interpretations – people have different interpretations. I was just looking, reading just now as I'm trying to get some other information. It says somebody online, this is a critical, I think Phantom is grossly underrated. Much of the criticism I've been able to read of the film describes it as an impotent depiction of an obsessive main character who keeps making frustratingly bad decisions, and yet that's the point. It's funny because, Murnau is the kind of director where you're going to get different opinions on some of his films, that, and they're drastic, because I just got finished saying to you I thought it was the weakest Murnau film that I had seen, and now there are people that are arguing that it's his most underrated film, which means basically that Murnau is the kind of director who needs to be watched and watched and watched and watched over and over again. He's one of the directors who, you know, you're going to get something out of him every new time you look at one of his films, and that includes Sunrise. Obviously, it would include a film like Faust. I mean, obviously. I mean, I feel guilty now that I told Aaron and you that Faust was knocking on the door at the top three. It's obvious people feel it's already there. It's already knocked through the door. I mean, and there are a lot of people flip a coin.
And it might have been Nosferatu.
Right.
I mean, you know, it's that close for me. Sometimes I even just tie Last Laugh and Faust at 2 and put Nosferatu at 3, but I wasn't going to cheat this week.
Right.
But,
right,
you
right.
know, I do think since we all have sunrise, and we all have the last laugh, and we all were really close on Faust. Now, we haven't talked a lot. We've talked a little bit about sunrise, but we haven't really talked about Faust or the last laugh. So I think we'll go with Faust first. And I'll start with you, Aaron. What do you want to say about Faust?
Oh, my gosh. Faust is one of those stories, right? I mean, we all know it, even if we don't realize we know it. It's been told so many times in so many ways, whether it's Faust or it's, oh, forgive me, the blues guitarist who sells his soul at the crossroads. Thank you. It's all Faust. Like, what's the cost of a human soul? But this is the greatest version of the story that is so timeless, because I think it's absolutely one of the most important questions. What is the worth of the what is your soul worth to you? Do you even believe you have a soul? Like, that's obviously not a question they're exploring in Faust, because they're going with the assumption that the devil is real and you have a soul and that you can sell, and that what will you give eternal damnation for? And can you make the devil lose a bet, basically? And the visuals in this film are out of this world. Over the top, grandiose. I believe it was the most expensive film ever made in Germany at the time, and then was unseated the very next year by Metropolis. Murnau and Lang going back and forth there.
Yeah, because I think it was Nibbling, then Faust, then Metropolis, and then Murnau was like, "Fuck it."
Yeah, I'm going to America. I mean, Faust is the result of the directly of The Last Laugh. The Last Laugh had such a small budget and made so much money that the studio literally said, "We'll bankroll anything. Make the movie you want to make." And Emil Jannings' performance, and this is, I guess, the last thing I'll say for right now. Jannings' performance as Mephisto is just so deliciously evil. He is eating the scenery, despite the fact that there's no talking.
And you can smell the bacon.
Oh, yeah. It's over the top in all of the best ways. And so, yeah, that's my rambling, incoherent response to my thoughts on Faust.
Now, Sammy, since you're a big proponent of The Last Laugh, what do you have to say about The Last Laugh? Hello? You still there?
Are you asking me? Are you asking Aaron?
You.
Me?
Yep.
Well, the first I was prepared to say something about Faust, since I didn't say anything about Faust. We had a couple of versions of Faust afterwards that were fascinating, and one of them was the devil. And Daniel Webster, which is All That Money Can Buy, 1941, the Hollywood version, which is actually a pretty solid film. And I remember the Faust legend, the devil, whatever, however you want to put it, was also done very well in Thriller, in Boris Karloff's Thriller, The Devil's Tick, which was arguably one of the five or six greatest episodes of Thriller that were ever made. It was a shuddery little tale about the devil and then how somebody sells their soul to the devil over a painting, it turns out to be. But certainly the most, somebody used the word grandiose, the most extravagant one was the one that Murnau made. And I believe he was helped out by the set designers that helped Robert Weed do The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. And of course, he tapped on a lot of the older versions again with his knowledge of Marlowe and of course Goethe. There was even an opera which I actually there was an opera which they once did at the Met called Faust by Charles Gounod. I think it would be safe to say that Murnau is drawing from all these literary sources, but then he's expanding it. And then, he makes something just that's such a visually phantasmagoric experience, phantasmagorical experience. As far as the last laugh, I mean, so much has to do with that lead performance. I mean, it's just that it's a mesmerizing, brilliant, tour de force central performance that he got there. The story is irresistible. It's a sad story of somebody who's, treated the way he's treated. As I compared it with Von Sternberg's film. I'm losing my pronunciation with Von Sternberg's film. And it's story wise, it's one of his great masterpieces. I mean, you stick with that from beginning to end. It's really a thematically rich work, and it's arguably of all his masterpieces the most literary in a good sense as well. So. Yeah, all right, so that's basically where I stand on it.
Mm. So now I'm going to ask the question that we always ask. Is there anything we haven't brought up so far with Murnau that you would like to bring up right now real quick, Sammy, before we go?
Hmm. Let me think. I'm thinking, going through my mind. We seem to be uniform in a lot of the opinions. I think the only thing we don't agree on is just how great Sunrise is. I mean, I Aaron and I are not, we're not on the same page with that film at all. I mean, I wouldn't duel him. I would never have a fight with him or duel him, but he's a great guy, and we are Cole Bergman fans. Bergman's our number one director, both of us, so we have a lot in common, but we're never going to come to terms. It's either going to get you emotionally, and we didn't really discuss, Aaron's the only one who even mentioned that word, emotion.
Yeah, we'll discuss that in a minute,
yeah.
But yeah.
And so the thing is... Sunrise has to hit you at a gut level, and I'm not buying into that middle hour not being effective. I was captivated by that middle hour as much as I was at the brilliant beginning and at the end, and I was invested in that drama. It had me in tears. I was just blown out of the water. There's not many movies that make me cry as much as that one did, and I'm a professional crier. When it comes to movies, I mean, the end of City Lights always makes me cry. Tears coming down my eyes. I can watch it 10 times in a row, that final scene. So many other emotional films. But, I think what Aaron said earlier, and this is the only thing I would add, is that Murnau stands apart in that he was able to, you know, to pull from you emotional reactions that a lot of directors couldn't. I mean, he was an extraordinarily emotional director in the way he presented his stories and, you know, used his visual arsenal. So that maybe that, you know, that's one of the aspects of his cinema that can't be shortchanged when you discuss his work.
Mm-hmm. So what about you, Aaron? Anything real quick that you'd like to say before we go?
Yeah, I'm going back to the visuals here and The Last Laugh. Edgar Ullman, who directed the absolutely incredible film noir Detour on like a penny budget.
I agree.
was working on The Last Laugh. And it is now historically confirmed that the first ever dolly was used in The Last Laugh. Going back to my point about him and the talkies and the technical innovations that he would be giving up in order to have sound in his films, that is one of the big ones. Like, he literally created the dolly. And to be stuck with that still camera, I just don't see how he would match.
Interesting. So, you know, I just have to say, you know, for me with Sunrise, you know, of course, Sunrise, you have the woman from the city that convinces the man to kill his wife, and he takes the wife out in a boat, and he almost does it, but he can't, but the wife knows what he was going to do, and they row back to shore, and she runs off, and he chases after her, follows her onto the train, and out into the streets of the city when they get there, and then he guides her through the street and everything, but that whole sequence from where she realizes what's happening until they start to reconcile is just achingly beautiful for me. And, you know, the rest of the movie, yeah, you know, I can see how some people might think it gets a little silly or a little broad, but it's two people falling in love again. And so I forgive it some of that, and it really works for me for that, because don't forget that the film has a subtitle. It's called Sunrise, A Song of Two Humans. So it's not exactly going to be, you know, super realistic. It's also not going to be something that isn't lushly romantic with all of that entails. Of course, you know, you do have the little problem of a man trying to kill his wife and the wife but quickly forgiving him. But hey, it's a movie.
I just wanted to throw in one question. Did you, when you mentioned the taking her out on the boat, so what was the later film, talkie film, where the results were quite different when that tried that?
God, you know, I've got the name of that movie on the tip of my tongue, and I can't think about it.
1950s.
Oh, God. Yeah, I can see the main actor's face. Like, Jesus. Yeah.
Shelley Winters.
But no.
Mm-hmm. Not Shelley Winters. No, now I'm losing it. Montgomery Clift.
Yeah. No, but that one did not
work. The Place in the Sun. That
this
wasn't the
this
same,
one does,
that one,
and
the
there's just something about it.
Oh.
Yeah, and there's just something about this one that it really, really, you know, completely works for me. Or as close to completely works for me as any film ever has. I rank Sunrise as my number 4 film of all time. It's my favorite silent movie of all time. But with that, I want to thank everyone out there who listened. I want to thank everyone who will be listening. And I want to thank you two for coming in. Please come back and listen to us again next week when we discuss soaps. Please come back in 2 weeks when we discuss Breaking Bad's amazing spinoff, Better Call Saul. And yes, it is absolutely amazing. Better Call Saul is a modern classic, folks. So with that, the show is a wrap. And we can say goodnight on the count of three. One, goodnight.
Goodnight.
Goodbye and thank you. Goodnight and thank you.